Welcome to Beyond from YVR, the Vancouver International Airport. I'm your host, Tamara Vrooman, President and CEO of YVR. YVR is located on Sea Island, which is the traditional territory of the Musqueam people, and I'd like to take this moment to pay our respects to elders past and present. We're here to go beyond and to form real connections. We dig deeper with local newsmakers to learn about their journey. Often it's the values they keep hidden, what's under the surface, that truly drives the person they present to the world. And let's face it, it also makes them fun to talk to and makes for an unforgettable connection. On today's episode of Beyond, we're talking to Dr. Bonnie Henry. Dr. Henry is British Columbia's provincial health officer, responsible for monitoring the health of our province and undertaking measures for disease control and prevention. It's certainly an interesting time for us to be talking with her. Today, we're going to talk to Dr. Henry about what she's learned from the last year and a half and how her life leading up to the COVID-19 pandemic prepared her for this unprecedented time in human history. And of course, we're interested in her thoughts beyond the pandemic to what she sees next. Delighted to have you here with me today, Dr. Henry. Welcome. So let's just talk a little bit about the beginning of the pandemic. So it's late 2019, you're getting ready for the holidays. You didn't know really what 2020 would offer, or did you have some early warning signs of what was to come?
I will say that in late 2019, there was storm clouds on the horizon from an epidemiologist point of view. And so there was some anxieties already as I was, I had a very unusual Christmas in 2019. My sister and I went to Barbados for Christmas as a little escape. But she recalls as well that I was really anxious the whole time because we had started to see some things that were happening in China that were giving me some qualms. And I look back on it now, and of course, it was really related to my previous experience in the city of Toronto with the SARS outbreak in 2003. And I jokingly refer to it as my post-SARS PTSD and anxiety, but it really was a very similar scenario that we were hearing about that was coming out of China.
For sure. So tell us a little bit for us non-epidemiological types. What do storm clouds look like to a public health officer?
That's a really good question because it's a combination of things. We look all the time. Part of what we do is surveillance, and it's a word that we use in the epidemiologic world to talk about seeing patterns of disease. And where is it arising and who's getting sick and where are they getting sick and what's the timing and is it unusual or is it the same as we usually see? So these are the things that help us see every year when influenza arrives or when we have outbreaks of measles or things that happen around the world. And we have a whole connected group of people who watch different diseases. And that's part of my job is to find out, you know, what things are we at risk for here in BC and in Canada. And one of the things that we watch really carefully all year round is influenza. And what we were hearing was the same things that we were hearing in 2003 and late 2002 in China, that there was these reports that were kind of coming through the network of influenza physicians and people like me who pay attention to these things. And they were saying there's an unusual flu-like thing that's happening in Wuhan. And the official word was, oh, no, it's nothing. It's, it's mild illness. It's contained. Nothing going on here. Nothing to watch. It's okay. So the chatter on the networks of us physicians who watch these things was kind of like, that's what they said in 2003. And so it was a lot of concern that was arising. And we were hearing different patterns about different things. So, that's a long way of saying we watch for flu all the time everywhere. After 2003, China had the best scientists in the world looking at SARS viruses, so coronaviruses. They also had really, really good scientists in Hong Kong and in parts of China who monitor influenza, because a lot of our influenza strains arise in that part of the world. And so when the usual people who are the experts in this were saying, we're not quite sure what this is, that made everybody a little bit anxious.
Deja vu all over again. You've been here before in Toronto when, of course, we had the SARS outbreak in 2002-2003. What did you do differently this time as a result of it being eerily disconcerting, it sounds like, but yet familiar?
Disconcerting was the word, and anxiety provoking, but I was not the only one. So I have colleagues who work at the BC CDC, Mel Krajdin, Denis Skowronski. We all were in that boat. We've been through this before. So we were all on a bit of heightened alert, and we were talking across the country and with my colleagues in the US. I have really strong relationships in Washington State, and we have the Pacific Northwest Border Health Alliance, where we meet regularly, and I meet with my colleagues, my counterparts from Alaska and Washington and California. Everybody was getting a little bit anxious about this. So what we did differently this time was people were paying attention. We were raising the alarm and not letting it go in the same way that we did before. And it was more behind the scenes, just making sure we had our testing ready to go, that we were, our sentinel physicians were alerted, the hospitals were alerted, the emergency departments were alerted, our public health colleagues all were watching to see if we started to see unusual patterns of illness as well. So we stepped up our surveillance.
I was actually in late February 2020 at a conference in Bern, Switzerland, which had in attendance many people from the northern part of Italy. And so that was when the outbreak was really starting in Italy. And so we all got on planes and got home as quickly as possible. And I was tested at that time in the parking lot of my physician's office because they weren't sure how to test people with a full suit and signing a privacy disclosure waiver because of the fact that we had to be tested in a public space. So they were ready to go. But I can tell you, my primary physician, who's excellent, was nervous.
We were all nervous when you don't know. And this is one of the things that I brought with me from my experience in SARS. When you have an unknown agent, you don't know if it's a virus or a bacteria or what it is. It's making people sick. You don't know what the incubation period is. You don't know which is the time it takes from when you're exposed to when you get sick. You don't know how it's transmitted for sure between people. There's, at least this time we had it, test, or we had a pretty good idea of a test, but there's no treatment, no vaccine, and you're kind of watching what's happening in places like Wuhan, and you watch what happened in Italy, and it is very concerning. The concerns that we had were, I spent a lot of time in the last 30 years of my career working on pandemic preparedness, on what do we do as a community and a global community. I'm part of a group with the World Health Organization. And ironically, maybe in November of 2019, there was a special meeting around specific pandemic preparedness aspects, what we call non-pharmaceutical interventions or public health measures that you might take to help curb a pandemic. And most of it was based around influenza, because we know influenza happens. So we were in Rome and had this meeting talking about, would you close schools? When do you close businesses? How do you manage large gatherings? And it was all somewhat theoretical based on our experiences with H1N1 in 2009 and based on things like having a vaccine in a certain period of time, having some treatments, which we had for influenza. And then all of a sudden, we were in the middle of something that wasn't influenza, but the same principles really applied. So it was going back to those same principles. How do you keep sick people away from well people, detect the sick people, provide them the care that they need safely, so that you try and reduce severe illness and deaths, obviously, which is our first goal. Our second goal, of course, was to keep our healthcare system going. Because if the healthcare system gets stretched too much, and we saw this in Italy, we were seeing it in New York City, then people who have other health needs can't get them met as well. And that means the health of the population suffers. But we also have to balance that with minimizing societal disruption, which is a fancy term for, you know, the unintended consequences, both negative and positive. So how do we measure those and make sure that we're minimizing the negative consequences of all of these measures, whether it's closing businesses, people being out of work, all of the mental health issues that come with that? And how do we enhance any of the positive things like connectedness? You know, people did find ways to connect in new and exciting ways that they hadn't done before.
Absolutely. So it's the beginning of March, and my only exposure to what was to come was an inconvenient and awkwardly executed first PCR test, which was negative, by the way. But by this time, as you've described, you knew that we were dealing with something quite different and quite significant. You knew that it would have significant repercussions for mortality, but also for the health system, for our community, for our economy, and for our way of life. And yet you're at the center of decision making and advice, and very, very quickly, the voice of communicating all of that complex, unprecedented from the average person's point of view, information that we needed to navigate. Where did you marshal the strength and the focus to be able to communicate all of that knowledge in the way that you did so effectively?
You know, it seems such a long, long time ago. I think the things that I learned working in Toronto with the SARS outbreak, working as I did with UNICEF and the WHO on polio eradication, working in the Ebola outbreaks in remote communities, you realize that when a community is in crises, you need to give people a sense of what you know and what you don't know. But I do believe, and I continue to believe, that if you tell people what you know, you tell people what you need them or want them to do and why. So that means sharing as much information as you can. Obviously, we have to protect people's individual privacy, but more importantly, you give people the means to do it. So you let people know that here's what you can do to control your environment right now. That invariably people will mostly do the right thing. And that's how you bring people along. You bring people along by our sense of commonness, that we're going through this together and we need to do these things together to support each other. And that's how we overcome some of the other things we learn in the crises, that people's reactions are based on their own experiences and backgrounds and what they've been through before. And for many people, something like this, going through a crisis, instills fear and anxiety. And sometimes that manifests in anger and lashing out because people feel like they have no control. So it's my job, our job, as leaders of these crises, to give people the means to do what we needed them to do and to support them in getting through this. And that was my aim at that time. And I'm thankful, you know, the government and the minister that I was working with, we all had the same common purpose.
And were you surprised at the public reaction? How every day at 3, most of the people of this province would tune in to listen to that advice and what you'd learned in the 24 hours since the last time you'd spoken, and the fact that your message at this unprecedented time would be the one that was so held on to.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still surprised. I'm still surprised when people recognize me. And I don't know. I felt that was my role to play at the time. And I've said this many, many times. There's a strong, you know, I'm the face and the voice of a strong team of public health leaders, of healthcare leaders, and of leaders in our community that have banded together to support each other through this. And that is, you know, my role is to make sure that we portray that information in a way that helps people get through this and supports them in getting through this. And, you know, I talk about, and then my phrase that has become so common, about kindness. And I absolutely believe that it's not just being nice. It's kind is recognizing that we're kin, that we are together in this. And it is recognizing that we're all coming from our own backgrounds. And kindness recognizes others' suffering and has compassion for that. And that is the thing that helps us get through hard times like this. And I've used that analogy that we're in a global storm and we're all in this same storm, but we're not all in the same boat. And we have to have that compassion. And instead of getting angry when somebody's doing something that makes no sense to you, that you think, oh, they shouldn't be doing that, taking a step back and asking, you know, what happened? What do you need? Why are you doing that? What can I do to help? And those are the things that keep us all safe. So it really came together in that sense of, okay, we have this common suffering. The other thing I talk about is where I come from, we have this saying, I'm a Far East Coaster, so I'm from Prince Edward Island. We say, you know, common suffering builds strong bonds. And we have that. And it's because we've recognized that we have a common suffering that we've been able to get through. I mean, not just this pandemic, but look what we have been through in this province. We've had heat domes and wildfires and the tragic discovery of unmarked graves in Tkamloops, you know, recognition of a suffering that people have been through for a long time. And of course, floods and landslides. And we really have to recognize that it is the resilience of us as a community that helps us as individuals get through these times.
You're listening to Beyond, a podcast from Vancouver International Airport. I'm your host, Tamara Vrooman. Our guest today is Dr. Bonnie Henry, BC's Provincial Health Officer. Dr. Henry has spent her entire career researching and fighting infectious diseases. So when the COVID-19 pandemic began in early 2020, she was the perfect person for the job. Today, Dr. Henry joins us to tell us what it's like to suddenly be in the midst of a global pandemic after studying infectious diseases for years, and how it's going 18 months later. So I'd like to talk about, of course, the other public health crisis that's been going on in our province, and that is the opioid crisis. And so the results of that have not fared as well as some of the progress that we've been made, even though it's been difficult, on the COVID pandemic. How do you see those two crises and what makes them different? And what can we learn about the differences between the two as we think about the kind of community and connections that we need in our province going forward?
It is the biggest tragedy that has happened in that we recognized early on that there were some populations who were more likely to have severe impacts if the pandemic, if this coronavirus got into those populations. And many of them are the same people who are having issues with homelessness and poverty and drug use. And if I think about the progress we had made, as slow as it was, we were getting somewhere in terms of addressing the toxic drug crises. But the measures that we put in place to protect people through this pandemic, particularly in early 2020, just undid all of that. So there was a number of different things. There was the fact that the overdose prevention sites and the supports that we had for people who were street involved and who were suffering from addictions in the downtown east side and other part communities, people were afraid because we couldn't come together, particularly indoors. So we had to reduce the number of people in shelters. We had put in plans because this was something that came from past history during the SARS outbreak in Toronto, where we knew people living in shelters were at particularly risk if that virus got in. So we had plans in place, but it really quickly became apparent that not having these supports meant that people were using drugs alone again. And all of the border measures that were put in place meant that people weren't traveling as much, and it meant the drug supply was interrupted, which led to a dramatically increased toxicity of the drug supply, things that we couldn't have particularly imagined that would be part of it. And that has been a horrendous tragedy that has been very challenging for us to try and manage. So one of the major casualties of the pandemic has been any progress that we've been making on addressing the toxic drug supply. And it's gone from a place where it was bad to much, much worse. So if I think about it, there are some progress that we've made. The complexity of the issues around why people use drugs. And Chief Doug Kelly says, you know, it's we don't have a drug problem, we have a pain problem. And it's intergenerational trauma, it's colonialism, it is poverty, it is psychic, emotional pain, as well as physical pain. And until we address that, we're only putting stop gaps in or putting fingers in the dike or band-aids on. So we have a lot of work to do on that. I think the other thing that the pandemic has made really apparent is that there's a group of people, and it's if we look at the statistics of people who've died in the last year and a half, there's been a dramatic increase in young men in the 30s to 50s who have mostly dying alone at home, who have families, who have jobs, who have social connections. And it has been the anxiety, the loss of that connection. They would normally be using or experimenting or with others. And the isolation that we've put in place to try and prevent transmission of this virus has meant that people are using alone, and the toxicity of what they're using has just gone through the roof. So it's many different fronts that we have to look at. And this emergency is one of complexities that are hard for people to grasp. I think we've put a human face on it for many people, but we still have those issues of shame and stigma around people who use drugs. And that keeps people from talking to their families, talking to their friends about their use of drugs. And that has led to tragic outcomes. Where we have made some progress is having a program to provide a regulated supply. So both diacetylmorphine, hydromorphone, fentanyl, that's medicinal regulated, but it's not accessible everywhere. And it's not easily accessible for people who don't use some of the services like overdose prevention services. The progress we're making on decriminalization of people who use drugs and getting that as part of our way of responding to this. It's not going to be the single answer, but is one of those things that takes away that fear that keeps people from talking about their drug use because they're afraid of being arrested and they're afraid of being in the criminal justice system and losing their kids and losing their job or not being able to drive. Those are the things that we need to address to be able to make some progress.
I certainly hear so much compassion in your voice, Dr. Henry, when you talk about the complexities of the opioid crisis, and yet rooted clearly in the science. And I think that's what's really been the message of inspiration that many people have associated with you. When we're getting the facts, we're also getting a dose of humanity and compassion in a time where it's in short supply. So where did you, during all of this time, go for inspiration? What things inspired you at times which I'm sure were challenging?
That's a really good question. I think I've heard it said, you know, that adversity reveals us to ourselves, you know, and what do we learn about ourselves during these times? And this is something that I've sort of taken with me from other crises that I've dealt with, that, you know, I am one of those people that tends to stay calm in a crisis. But it's hard, you know, and I think what I've learned and what I take inspiration from is what I see all around me, where people are resourceful and they're brave and they're supportive. And that sense of unity. And, you know, I particularly have been struck by how challenging this time has been for our elders and seniors. But I am inspired by them. I get notes, I get messages from people. Even, you know, I got notes from people who were in lockdown in long-term care homes saying that they understand. And the resilience and adaptability of youth is the other part that I get inspiration from. I heard loud and clear from people that when schools were closed, families suffered, children suffered, community suffered. So that's been a priority. And I just get so many inspirational notes from young people about how important it is, even if it's different and even if it's not what they want it to be, that being in school is important. So those are the things that keep you going when you recognize that you can make a positive difference and help people get through this.
Absolutely. And when you and I first met, it was at the airport when we invited you to the airport to see what we were doing in the early days of the pandemic to make sure that people that needed to travel for essential reasons were able to do so safely and with the protocols that you and the federal government established. And to this day, of course, we continue to wear masks and they're a part of our daily lives in many, many places, particularly public ones. And certainly at our airport. What do you think is going to be some of the lasting legacies of this time? Everything from, you know, what we wear and how we interact to how we see each other.
You know, that's a really good question. I think some of it will be hopefully a heightened recognition of our global community. That, you know, things that happen in China affect us. Things that happen in Iran affect us. Things that happen in India affect us in a big way. And that we need to remember that. And some of the little things that we do are not just for ourselves, but for our community. So wearing a mask, it's a sign of respect. Not just because it protects me, but because it protects my community. Being vaccinated is a measure, an action we take for ourselves because it protects us and our family and those we're closest to, but it also protects our community, helps us get out of this pandemic. And these little things that we do make a difference, not just to our family, but to our community, to our province, and to our global health.
I can tell you here at the airport and in aviation, as you know, we are one of the first, in fact, probably only fully vaccinated sectors and industries in the country. And there's been some challenges with implementing that are well reported. But I can tell you, by and large, our people, 26,000 people who work at our airport, are very, very proud to be part of that first sector. But that's not true across all sectors. As the leader and the voice of the team that has to adjudicate and navigate even through these later days of the pandemic, have you been surprised at some of the public backlash to some of the things that are really acts of community and compassion in one way, but have taken quite a different tone in parts of our society?
It has been discouraging and disheartening at some points, particularly some of the personal vitriol and attacks. I worry sometimes that we know that there are organized disinformation campaigns that are run, and we increasingly know that they're run from people who have agendas, whether that's white supremacy, whether that's organized gangs, and our government actors in some cases. And it really upsets and worries me when I see people, regular thinking people, who start to take up some of these clearly erroneous pieces of information that are being spread with an agenda. So that is the hardest thing to try and counter, but the very specific things that are designed to try and frighten people about vaccines. But, you know, we also need to take a measured approach to it and say, well, here's the truth. I get discouraged by some of the polarization of the discourse, and I think a lot of that comes from how close we are to the U.S., where it has become very much a political issue. I'd like to think that in Canada we don't think that way, but it certainly has permeated some parts of our province. And again, needing to go back to that compassion and understanding that people come with their different impressions and ideas of things, and to try and keep things positive. And that's the approach that I'm trying to take. It's not about othering people. It's about saying, well, you know, here's what I know about this. Here's what I think you need to consider when you're making these decisions, and really supporting people to get the right and correct information. It's not going to work for everybody. There are some people that are intensely wedded to their views and their opinions, and that's fine. And I absolutely 100% support their right to have those opinions and to make those decisions. But it's also my job to make sure that I'm putting in place the measures that we need to protect people. And if you make the decision, for example, not to be vaccinated, that is absolutely your 100% your right to make that decision. But it has consequences. And those consequences are when your decision affects the health and well-being of others.
I really like the idea that you said a few moments ago about othering. It's a bit of a paradox, isn't it, at this time of common storm, as you said, that we're all in this together, that idea of othering has become so divisive. I had an opportunity very recently to speak with Maria Ressa, the recent Nobel Peace Prize winner for journalism in the Philippines, where she's made a career out of really confronting misinformation and corruption. And she had a very powerful idea about the fact that misinformation is important because when we don't share common facts, we lose our ability to have things in common. And when we lose our ability to have things in common, democracy suffers because we don't have the ability to see the value of coming together for some kind of solution. And I think that very basic insight that's come through the pandemic around the fact that if we don't have a way to connect one another with facts, with information, which has been so much a part of what you've been doing day after day in service of the public, very, very hard for us to have a common experience.
That's, I hadn't thought about it that way, but I absolutely agree. I think, and you know, we talk about misinformation is sort of unintentional passing on of information that's incorrect. But what's more and more difficult is the intentional passing on of incorrect information to make people take a certain action. So disinformation is what we're calling it. And that is even more divisive and insidious.
And so as we're still in the pandemic, what are you thinking about for the future? What gives you hope? What are some of the things that you're looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to travel. Travel is something that helps us see the world and you know, see our commonalities and learn. So that's something that I'm excited about. One of the things that I am hopeful that we will get out of this is not going back to the way we were. Recognizing that there have been some positive things that have come out of this, even how we interact with people, that we don't actually necessarily need to all be in one place all the time, and that we can connect with people, meaningfully connect with people without having to travel long distances and things. And that those connections are important, even if they are virtual. The other thing that I think is important, I often think of Rachel Carson, who said, you know, most of us walk unseeing through this world, unaware alike of its beauties and the tragic intensity of the lives being lived all around us. Well, we can't say that anymore. We have seen that things like this pandemic, which affect everybody, have a differential effect on certain populations, on racialized populations, on Indigenous people, on women, on youth. So we can't unsee that. And I think our challenge and our what we need to do as a community now is say, okay, we've recognized that these are things that lead to inequities. And those inequities lead to people having poorer health, people dying before another. How do we build back in a more just way?
Absolutely. Beyond the pandemic, we do need to remember what we've seen. I like that idea. We can't unsee it once we've seen it. What's your advice for people who may be listening, who are thoughtful, young people, elderly, single moms, working parents, and everybody in between that care about the province, that endured a lot as we've gone through these past several months, but absolutely want to take something positive forward for the future? What's your advice to them? Where do they start?
You know, I think recognizing, and I talked about our common suffering, and recognizing we do have that bond, that we have been through this together, and these things that were hidden for a long time are no longer hidden. So it's okay to talk about the tragedies that happened because of colonialism and the residential schools. And it's important for us to do that, and that we need to find the words to do that, that we can make meaningful change. We've seen as well in this province, probably more than many other places, the effects of climate change. And, you know, pandemics and climate change go together. But we've also seen how adaptive and resilient we can be. That resilience depends on how we do things together and how we have that sense of community. So I do think that going forward, we're all in a different perspective. And we need to take this, you know, relentless uncertainty and remind ourselves that we can build back better and that we can do it together with this strong common bond that we have, and that we have to have unrelenting kindness guide us.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Henry. It's been a privilege really to listen to you and hear your reflections, benefit from your wisdom as you've navigated what has certainly been an unprecedented time for us, but we're better as a province for your leadership. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. That's very kind.
Thanks again to our guest today, Dr. Bonnie Henry. And thanks to all of you for listening to Beyond from YBR. This show is brought to you by YBR. The show producer is Nathan Atnikoff, edited by Diego Domine, with audio production by Jar Audio. Remember to subscribe to Beyond in your favorite podcast app for more conversations, diverse perspectives, and ideas about how we can all go beyond. See you next week.